Hey there, Curiosity Builders. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. How are you using experiments to grow through barriers such as perfectionism, inertia, and the status quo? That is a question I explore with today's guest, Kay Coughlin, an entrepreneur, podcaster, and life coach for caregivers. She also happens to be my business coach, and I'm her podcast producer. In this conversation, we explore experiments and the primary role of noticing emotions, thoughts, beliefs, and data without judgment in the experimentation process. She shares about how to overcome confirmation bias, the value of failure, being okay with discomfort, building successful collaborative partnerships, and all things boundaries. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/547.
The first thing is that I really want to know what people are really thinking and what they really want and what they really need, so that we can make a plan and in life and work, whatever, to move forward. Mm-hmm. So that that stuff is not a problem, so that that stuff is just data and we can just make a plan and move forward. And I also am endlessly curious, like to the point of not being able to sleep at night, because I want to know why we as humans keep doing the same things we've always done, the same old way we've always done them, and why we can't move past that and just try new things.
Yeah.
We cause ourselves so much suffering by holding so tightly to those old ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to live in suffering. And I don't want the people around me who I care about, I don't want them to live in suffering either. And we do so much to cause ourselves to stay there. Mm-hmm. I can't get enough of learning about that because I really want to overcome it. I do.
That's fascinating. And I love first that you're talking about thinking, wanting to know what people think, because I just released the episode like a minute before we recorded of today's monologue, which was about overthinking. So what is the connection between thinking and overthinking?
Wow. That's a deep question, Chris. Here's what I want to tell you. I know a lot of people, myself included, for whom overthinking is part of our process. So I think the difference between thinking and overthinking, okay, I'm just going to put it this way, is that we like to believe that thinking is okay and that overthinking is a problem. What if overthinking is just a cue? It's just a signal that we've gotten to the point where maybe we're putting too much effort in, or we actually have enough data and we can move forward, or we've encountered a problem that we can't get past. You know, what if it's just a signal, something to notice and say, oh, I'm overthinking this. What's really going on here? Why am I doing this? And then it's not a problem. Then it's just thinking. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the difference.
I like that, because the connection that I was starting to make was, overthinking, at least for me, often leads to suffering. and getting so stuck in my head that I can't break free of things like perfectionism and fear and anxiety and worry. Thinking that I don't have that problem generally with just thinking about something. It's when I ruminate. Someone that I know has used that word recently, ruminate. It was you.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. It's a good word. And I completely agree. And I think we're getting at the same thing, but we're coming at it from a different way. You are making overthinking into a quote unquote problem. You're judging it as a problem but you don't judge thinking that way. That's another thing I'm curious about, is how can we get to a point where we just don't judge ourselves so much, where we kind of just take ourselves at face value and say, oh gosh, that's so interesting. What am I doing, and what do I want to do instead?
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, one of the things that I'm curious about with you, Kay, is what drew you to the world of entrepreneurship?
I think I've been an entrepreneur as long as I can remember. My very first job was delivering newspapers. And yes, you're working for somebody else, but that really is entrepreneurship, because if you want to get paid more, you have to get more subscriptions, which means you have to go door to door with hang tags or knocking on doors and saying, do you want to buy newspapers? Now, I'm dating myself, obviously. This was a long time ago. This would have been back in the 80s. And you have to do all the other things entrepreneurs do. You have to do your own billing. You have to do your own collections. Oh my gosh. That's another conversation, doing collections when you're 13 and going door to door with papers. But I have always been very entrepreneurial. I think because I am so curious, and in what I'm sure is one of my most irritating traits, and I'm sure it was when I was being employed by other people, I just don't stop at the status quo. I'm always saying, okay, look, I see what we're doing now, but I want to know why we're doing it this way. And I want to know if there's another way we could do this. And there have been probably literally a million times when a supervisor of mine just wanted to say to me, shut up and do your job and stop questioning everything. And I never been able to shut that part of myself off. And I think that's probably what draws me the most to entrepreneurship, because I have as much leeway as I want to ask that question. Now, I also have to pay attention to my bottom line, and I can't indulge in that necessarily. Right. But at the same time, I get to build a business that is, I guess to use your phrase, endlessly curious and never willing to settle for the bottom line. And, you know, as I grow, I want to surround myself with people who are courageous about doing that as well, no matter how much they might think that there's a role they should or shouldn't have, you know, based on the fact that I'm the founder or the CEO or whatever. I always want people to say to me, you know, I've got an idea, or even more exciting, I've got a question. Oh, I really want that. I don't think that's very welcome in the corporate world. It certainly wasn't ever for me. There were some environments where it was better than others. But I've had at least a side hustle going on, gosh, I mean, since I was 22 years old. So even while I worked full time, even while I had babies at home, you know, I always had at the very least a side hustle, if not a stretch of a year or two where I was trying to make a go of it on my own completely. So I've always been in that space in my head.
The first thing I thought of when you said, you know, a 13-year-old collector of money, I thought of the movie Better Off Dead, where John Cusack, it's like a skiing movie. And there was like this kid who showed up at points throughout the movie saying he wanted his $2. And that was like that underlying theme of like, I want my $2. That was a total tangent and side note, but like, I just had that pop into my head, and it would be really funny if you'd seen the movie, but you know what? It's okay.
I'm sure there were people in the very small town that we lived in who saw me coming and turned around and went the other way on the sidewalk, because they knew they owed me probably $7.35, you know, for a month's worth of papers or something. So I'm sure that was me too.
That's awesome. Well, as you're approaching entrepreneurship and you start recognizing in yourself that you have these qualities of searching for a better way to do things, and wanting to search for those better questions, how did you reconcile that tension that I think sometimes you feel between what you know to be true for yourself and what you want for yourself?
Wow, you are never going to ask an easy question, are you, Chris? You've always got to go for the hard ones. I have, probably since I was very tiny, been searching for new ways to understand myself because I have always been so able to feel that gap that you just described between what's expected of me or what I want and who I truly am. Mm-hmm. And what I've just done over the years is I have continuously pushed myself to find new ways to become aware of who I really am, mm-hmm. and never to give up until I get to the core. And I think at this point, and I'm 48 now as we're recording this, there are a few things in my life and a few things about me that I think that I've come to understand as foundational to who I am. Mm-hmm. And I've been able now to start incorporating that into my business and into my life and into my, you know, search for the truth in my faith. And it's feels so good. It's so rewarding. And is there tension in it? Heck yeah. There is a lot of tension in it. And I've just come to see that as normal for me. I don't know that I could give up the seeking if I was forced to. Mm-hmm. I would not be happy unless I were seeking. And, you know, in that seeking place, there's just going to be the tension there. And that's just normal for me. And I'm okay with that.
What I love about that a lot too is it speaks to one of my favorite things about you, Kay, is that you are a constant experimenter. You're constantly trying things. You're constantly trying to get at the better way, not just the better way, but like the more optimal way, the more interesting way. And so, you know, where did you learn to value experimentation?
I just have to go on record as saying that I am a perfectionist to a very, I mean, to an extreme. And if anyone listening to this knows the Enneagram, I am a one on the Enneagram, which is very much known as the perfectionist. There's other names for it too, but it's a perfectionist. And boy, talk about what's at the core of my being. That's at the core of my being. And part of that for me means that I cannot break rules. Mm. And if I do break a rule, I have to tell someone I'm doing it because I have to make sure that someone knows that I'm breaking a rule because you don't break rules if they're there. Now, I also fight against rules that I don't believe in so that I can get them changed because if it's going to cause me too much pain to break a rule, then I have to get a new one made. Mm-hmm. So what I figured out, I don't know, probably back when I was in maybe, I don't know, probably 12 or 13, probably about the time I had my paper out, was that experimenting is actually a rule of science. I am very persuaded by science. I love data. I'm an amateur behavioral scientist. I you know, almost went to college in a very intense scientific field. I just love science. So that is a rule of science. And what that means for me, I can interpret that and use experimenting then in anywhere in my life where there's a problem, certainly where my perfectionism holds me back, where there's a rule that I don't agree with, I can say to myself, well, I'm going to do an experiment and see what else I can find out because I'll come out with data and it's part of the scientific process. So it's a way that I have found to let myself give myself permission to grow without, literally, it's an end run around this part of me that makes it so that I can't break rules. Well, one of my rules is experimenting, and that takes precedence over most other ones for me. And I just have to keep coming back to it, or I would be paralyzed and unable to move forward in my life. I have no doubt about that. It's how I make progress.
So you mentioned perfectionism. Are there other temptations or barriers or whatever we want to call them that you've had to overcome when approaching and conducting experiments?
Well, I mean, certainly there's the way things have always been done. I actually wrote a paper for a trade journal several years ago now about inertia in the workplace, which was the first time that I had really started to do any kind of deep study on why we do the things we do and why it's so hard to change. Now, because I'm also a behavioral scientist, I am very intrigued by that primitive brain that keeps us, that likes to keep us in our current state, whatever that is. And like, you know, that's inertia showing up in our lives. It's takes less energy for a body to stay in its current state of inertia, whether it's moving or resting or whatever. The thing that I have to do is I have to know that that inertia of keeping things the way they are is going to be there. So that's always going to be a roadblock. It doesn't have to be an obstacle, right? You can turn it from a roadblock into a road bump. You can let it be an obstacle that you can't get around or that you can't come over. I truly believe it's just the recognizing that that's always going to be there. And it's not just me. It's every person I run into. It's certainly every system that I run into. You know, currently what I do is I am a coach for caregivers. And one of the things that I'm always attuned to is this system that caregivers, that we find ourselves in. I'm a caregiver too. I'm actually a sandwich family caregiver. I have kids at home and I care for my mom, which makes me a sandwich family caregiver. So there were all these systems that I became a part of, whether or not I asked for them. That's the inertia of the system. And I simply have to be aware that, particularly as a caregiver, every time I turn around, there's going to be all of these expectations and maybe norms and beliefs that other people have about what it means to be a caregiver. And those are going to be in my way. And so what are the experiments that I can do to change that? Because a lot of the caregiver experience is, or I would say, let's say the stereotype of being a caregiver is that you have to sacrifice everything in your life. Because that is literally the story that we're told about being a caregiver. That's the inertia that I'm trying to overcome. Mm-hmm. It's just a belief like anything else. It's not necessarily true, but I have to be able to see all those other things that are in the way. So it could come from me. It could come from a lot of other places. And I feel like it's my job just to always be looking for that so that I know it's coming up. And so that when it comes up, I'm not surprised. And I can say to myself, what do I do now? Do I know how to get around this? Do I know how to get over this? Or is it time to do an experiment?
Right. That's, I love the experiment within experiment. That's very meta.
Very meta.
or is the word recursive? I don't know. But what's interesting is, like, you mentioned surprise. And I'm sure there's other emotions that pop up when you're in experiments. So how have you learned to separate those emotions that are necessary, obviously, and the data that you're after?
Well, I think the key there is noticing everything and not even necessarily trying to separate it out while you're going through it, mm-hmm. but make a note of it. I use a tool I call thought downloads to write everything down. And then you can go back and look at that. I go back and I look at that and I say, okay, so which part of this was an emotion? Which part of this was a belief? Which part of this was somebody else's thought? Which part of this was data? And the real trick there, we get back to judgment here, is going back and looking at whatever I learned during an experiment, including emotions that I felt, and looking at that without judgment and saying, okay, this is what happened. I felt this emotion. Well, I guess at that point, the emotion itself becomes data. Mm-hmm. So I know that when I try something new, I'm going to be scared. I'm going to be apprehensive. I have some new things coming up. And when I think about them, I do go right into that place of just outright fear and like sweating and heart palpitations. And because I know that's normal, it's not a problem. I say, oh, I don't like it, but it's just really normal for me to be afraid. That's my data. And I'll tell you what I think that really allows me to do is be really present, just be right here in the moment, mm-hmm. whether it's for myself or for someone else. Certainly it helps so much as a parent to be able to take all of the things my kids are telling me and just be there with them and let them sort it out for themselves and just love them unconditionally. It's a big help to me as a caregiver too. Mm-hmm. What it means is that my mom and I can have a difference of opinion on something and I can still be right there with her in whatever the moment is. And I don't necessarily have to be her child. I can be her friend, or I can be, you know, an adult in an adult situation with her. And it keeps bringing me back to the present and to the present moment. So for me, everything becomes data. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, seeing it as data allows me to love people better.
That's so interesting, because what I'm hearing you say is that, I mean, obviously noticing and observation is a part of the scientific method.
Yes.
And what I love about it is you're not trying to change what you're noticing. You're trying to respond because what you're noticing is there. So it's like you're not trying to change what has happened. You're trying to respond to what has happened. It just seems like a very massive shift for me, because what for myself, it's less about wanting to notice and more about changing. I'm not quite sure where the question is, but it's really this idea of the power of noticing without judgment.
Yeah. And I think you've really hit the nail on the head there. What that allows you to do eventually. I'm not going to tell you that it's easy. I'm not going to tell you that it's necessarily quick, because it does take a significant shift in your mind mm-hmm. and in the way you look at the world. But it does, it has allowed me to go from reacting mm-hmm. to instead being intentional about how I respond. Yeah. And I'm a quick thinker, and I'm quick in a conversation, and I have had to learn to slow myself down, and I have had to learn to say to people, "Hang on, don't interrupt me. I'm processing something here. Just give me a minute." That allows me to respond, and I'm just so much more content with myself as a person and as an entrepreneur, and certainly as a coach, when I can stay in it and come from a place of responding with that intentional piece rather than mm-hmm. reacting out of habit, which, oh my gosh, you know, our defaults and our habits, those lead us down so many roads we don't want to go down. It leads us to that suffering. I just don't want to spend time there if I don't have to. Mm-hmm. So instead, I do try really hard to build new habits that let me respond instead of react.
Nice. It's interesting, Kay. I'm thinking at this moment about confirmation bias. That sometimes when we set out, I'm going to say we, because I think this is a human quality, that when we experiment, we have the outcome in mind that we want.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's different than the other part of the scientific, is having a hypothesis of what's going to happen and being okay with the outcome of that hypothesis. So if the outcome is different than what you hypothesize, that's good. But we want that confirmation bias. We want our ideas to be confirmed. We want to feel good. We want that. So how have you learned to enter an experiment without that need for your desired outcome to be confirmed?
Well, I mean, I want that too. You know, I would be lying if I said that I went into an experiment with a purely, you know, need to have a hypothesis either confirmed or denied. That would be great. But I go into these experiments too with the same confirmation bias. And like I'm teaching myself to do as much as possible, I try to approach that by recognizing up front what I want my outcomes to be. Mm-hmm. So that I know what I know what my trajectory is, mm-hmm. but also so that I can be aware of my own biases to get what I want. Mm-hmm. I think, Chris, it's that noticing, it's that awareness, and knowing that I'm human, and so I'm going to fall for confirmation bias all the time anyway, that just gives me a lot of freedom to kind of take the pressure off of myself. Mm-hmm. And it also, I think, gives the people in my life probably more leeway to say to me, well, can you look at something else? Or are you sure that's what you want? Or, you know, what if you don't get that? What are you going to do? If I can remind myself that I'm in this for an experiment and that this is all data, then I'm less attached to the outcomes. That doesn't mean that there are times when I'm not totally devastated. There are so many times when I'm completely blindsided by the way something turns out. There are for sure times when I am frustrated and disappointed. Mm-hmm. But I'm just willing to go through it because I'm not willing to like be who I was yesterday. I have to always keep pushing forward so I don't get stuck there.
Yeah. So would you say that's the secret to getting through failure? Is that willingness to go through the hard stuff?
Yes, it's that. For me anyway, I don't know if it is for everyone, of course. I tell my kids, I have two teenage boys, and I tell them on a fairly regular basis that fail is my favorite four-letter F word. And we talk about failure at the dinner table sometimes. You know, what have you done? Yes, we do. We talk about it at the dinner table. What have you done lately that didn't turn out?
Wow.
Because we usually hide from our failures. Oh, and we try to hide them from each other. And they're so painful to feel like there's parts of ourselves we have to hide. And I really, because I'm such a perfectionist and I've always felt like I had to hide my failures from people, like it was literally going to kill me if I admitted that I failed. I just don't want to pass that legacy on to my kids. And so we talk about it at the dinner table. And we believe in failing. We don't believe that failing should be easy or fun, but we believe it's just a really important part of the process. And I'll tell you what, Chris, we let our kids fail. Mm-hmm. In school, in sports, with their friends, sometimes we can see it coming. We can see the bad grade coming, or we can see a bad result in sports or whatever coming. And we let our kids do that because we want them to learn to fail. I mean, I know that that's mostly been me doing that between my husband and I. He's not quite as comfortable talking about failure as I am, I won't lie. But failure is a mindset. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's just part of my process. It hasn't been easy. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is not fun. Right. But it's normal for me now. I'm like, oh, I'm going to try something new. That means I'm probably going to fail at some of this stuff. Okay. That's how it works for me. It's just so much less painful that way.
Right. I'm intrigued too, Kay, because oftentimes societally, we don't let women fail and that we give latitude to men fail. So it's interesting to hear how your husband is a little bit less prone to want to go through failure and you're willing to like step into the discomfort and experiment and try things and rewrite those societal tropes.
I think that's a little bit more how I'm wired. My mom is a pretty good example of someone who, you know, doesn't want to fail or for others to see their failure. And one of the experiments that I run with my mother now, so she lives next door to us. She's in a house that's attached to our garage. So there's 30 feet between us. It's a great arrangement. I highly recommend that if you're going to be a caregiver, that there's a little bit of space between your houses. And my mom and I adore each other. And there are many times when the experiment I'll do with my mom is I will say, I don't like the way we did that, Mom. That feels to me like a pattern we've had for a long time. Can we try this again? I want to do that differently. I want to see if we can make this work differently. And to her credit, she is always willing to go along with that. And she's told me many times that that's not anything that was ever modeled for her. That's not anything she ever saw anyone do. And that it's one of her favorite things about our relationship is being grown-ups together and being willing to say, let's try that one again. That didn't work out very well. And we've been able to do some really hard things and have some really hard conversations just because we give ourselves the grace to have that kind of experiment going on and fail sometimes. And that's just part of it.
I love what you just said right there, because I think it applies not only to the situation that you just shared with your mom, but I mean, that is the perfect illustration for business too, of saying to a client, if something didn't work out, I don't like the way that happened. Can we try that again? And I think there's power in that, but there's also a vulnerability in admitting that it didn't turn out perfectly and working through to the other side of that. It just seems so powerful.
Yes, I have to agree. And most people aren't used to that, Chris. I'll be totally honest. I mean, if you think about it, has anyone ever said that to you? I mean, other than me and our working relationship?
No,
we don't say that to each other. We aren't taught to say that to each other. And it is extremely powerful to know that you've got the skill. I mean, it's a skill to be able to recognize it, see what's going on, and then have the language to say, let's try that one again. Or, you know, tell me what it is about that that you liked and tell me what it is about that that you didn't like. Mm-hmm. And let's see what we can do differently. Let's keep the parts that worked. Let's look at some of the other things. And most people are, no lie, not used to that kind of honesty. It makes people uncomfortable. And I have had to learn to just stay in the conversation and be okay with the discomfort, to let people kind of work through that, kind of let that wiggle through their system. Because what's on the other side of that is always a relationship or a working relationship that's so much more meaningful.
Yeah. So one of your experiments that you started recently was a podcast called From One Caregiver to Another. Where did that idea come from? How did that become an experiment that you had to try?
I decided that during the month of January that I wanted to do daily or almost daily messages of encouragement for caregivers. A lot of what caregivers hear is very discouraging. There's very little, I don't want to say positive support, but there's very little in the way of truly loving and helpful communication for caregivers. There's lots of people blaming and shaming caregivers out there, and that is the primary message that we hear. Mm-hmm. When people talk about caregivers at all, it often tends to be, oh, poor you, or you should have done this differently, or it's your fault that this didn't work out. When caregivers often have very little control over the actual situation, the only thing we have control over is how we come to a situation. So I just decided that I wanted to do these daily messages, which for me was going to be easiest to do an email series because that was easiest for me at the time. But a few years ago, I had started recording just short videos. I was putting them up like on LinkedIn. And I had several people reach out to me and say, I like your videos so much, but what I do is I'll just turn it on in the background. I won't even look at it. I'll just listen to your voice because I like hearing your voice. It had never occurred to me that there was something about my voice that could be an asset to me, or in this case, to my business. And so I decided to put the two together and to really challenge myself during the month of January to not only do these daily messages, but to turn them into basically a month-long podcast. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what I was doing. I had okay equipment at the time. I just figured it out as I went along. I think I ended up doing 25 or 26 of them. So I took Sundays off. I took MLK Day off. And I just challenged myself to produce this basically 6 days a week. I learned so much. It was a great experiment. And by the end of it, I knew that I loved doing it, that it was worth doing, that I had something to say, that I'd like the way my voice sounded in the podcast format, and that I couldn't do it by myself. I couldn't do the podcast production. I just didn't enjoy the producing side of it enough to be able to turn it into an ongoing weekly podcast, which is what I wanted.
What I love about that too is that you have developed an ability to not only experiment, but know when it's time to iterate or abandon. And so, you know, producing 25 or 26 episodes of a podcast, I mean, technically speaking, that's a great run. how did you know that you wanted to turn it into a weekly show and grow it to the next level?
I had to give myself permission to do the first version of it. And then after it was done, to step back and look at it and say, what worked? What didn't work? What do I like? What did I not like about that? How can I really turn this into something that's going to be meaningful to me and fun for me and, you know, really make the most out of whatever asset this is. And that was how I asked the question. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this or not, but you, Chris, are my podcast producer. And I reached out to you and I basically said as much. Like, I did this experiment. I've got all of this information now. I've got this data now. And I don't know what I need. And you offered to help me figure out what I need. And we've created a working relationship that allows me to really bring my best to my podcast and has allowed me to go so far with that. And I never could have done that on my own. I was so glad that I did that because it helped me to see what I needed in a partnership, what I needed by way of help, where I needed a push, where I'm probably going to be the one to be pushing other people. It was just, I got so much out of it. And it was because I let myself get a lot out of it. I got to the end of it and I said, here's what I wanted to do. I did what I wanted to do. Now, what did I learn?
And what did you learn?
Well, I learned that I loved it. Mm-hmm. That I didn't like doing the audio producing piece of it. And also what I learned was that when I was producing it by myself, so recording it, but then producing it, turning it into the finished piece, because I don't necessarily think I have a gift for that finished piece either, I wasn't bringing as much joy to it as I wanted. I'm not sure that I was bringing as much vulnerability to it as I wanted. Mm-hmm. I'm certain that I wasn't getting as deep. And I wasn't being as conversational as I wanted because I was always kind of worried about that end piece. Mm-hmm. And so when I came to you, I think that was one of the things I said is I want to enjoy this process more. I want to get as much out of it as I can. And that's why I need help, because I want someone who can release me from the things that I just don't love doing, so that I can do the pieces I love doing and make this the best it can be. And it has definitely worked out that way for me.
That is amazing. Not only because I get to work with you on this, but I think you've shared a model for how to approach collaboration that is empowering and healthy. And what it is through noticing, you're noticing where you're strong, you're noticing where there's a lack of joy that you're bringing to it. And you know, because I think a lot of times we speak of collaboration of, you know, where I'm weak, you're strong. And it's just, I mean, that's fine. I mean, that's a perfectly acceptable model of collaboration. But when you can let go of the joyless things and allow me to do what I do, you know, with my abilities, it just, I think that is that collaboration that sings, because it's not about strengths and weaknesses.
Well, and I have another term for that. It's actually cake and cringe. So for me, the cake part of it is the easy stuff, the stuff that comes really naturally to me. It's the writing of the podcast, and it's recording it and letting myself, you know, sink into it and enjoy the process and bring everything to it that I can. But the cringe part of it for me, really, and the stuff that didn't come naturally, was that producing piece. But then also I had a fear that, like, I was not hearing things or that I was missing things. And so I record these things and I turn them over to you. And our collaboration, I mean, yes, you do the producing piece for me, but another thing that you do for me is you really listen to it. And you give me reassurance that I have brought my full self to the project. You give me a confidence I couldn't have by myself. And so it's so much more than simply the audio production work that you do. It's that I trust you, and I trust you to hear my voice and to tell me if you think something has gone wrong. And every time I turn one of these episodes over to you, and you know this, I say, I uploaded a recording for you, work your magic on it. And that's what you do. You work into your cake, and I get to work into my cake. And between the two of us, what comes out the other end is something that has become quite beautiful and very meaningful.
Yeah, I would agree. And I like cake. So, I mean, it's a win. Another area that you are passionate about is boundaries.
Yeah.
And that's definitely an area that everyone, not to mention creative people, creators, creative entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all need practice in setting and respecting boundaries. So I thought I'd just start with, how do you define boundaries?
Well, the simplest definition of boundaries, and if anybody wants to hear a lot about boundaries, by the way, they can take a look at my podcast, because I've done at least 2 episodes on this now, maybe 3, and it's sprinkled throughout at least the last 10 episodes, so it's all in there. But I think the easiest definition, the best one I've ever heard, is a boundary is what's okay and what's not okay with you. And I think that's the hardest part about boundaries, is deciding what's okay and what's not okay. And then the second hardest part is going to be communicating that to other people, because it's not a boundary until you tell somebody else. And by the way, boundaries are not about controlling other people. Boundaries are about you as a person, and things that you've decided about what you will and will not do when certain circumstances occur. So, like, if I were to say to you, I don't know, I'm not going to work with you until you get a certain piece of equipment. That's not a boundary. That would be me trying to control you. But if I were to say to you, you know, in order to do my best work, I need to work with a producer who's using X equipment, and so I'm going to go find a producer who uses that equipment, that's my boundary. That's a decision I've made about me and about an action I will take. So it's not about controlling you. It's about knowing what I need and don't need. And so that's a boundary at its most basic.
Right. Well, and what I'm hearing too is sometimes when boundaries overlap, that can be a Venn diagram of goodness. Because if you said that was your boundary, and one of my boundaries was to respond to those requests and be like, okay, do I like working with this person? Will I meet their boundary and expand mine to include theirs?
Yes, I think you're completely right about that. You know, one of the things that we don't talk about with boundaries much when it comes up, because it's so hard to do, that most of us just go, our brains just go right into the fear of what the consequences will be if we set boundaries. Like, what if I set a boundary and somebody's angry at me or cuts me off? And everybody's mind always goes right to, you know, what if I set a boundary at work and they fire me? Like, our brains always go there. But what, and I get it, that's that primitive brain trying to keep you safe, doing its job. But one of the beautiful parts about boundaries is that it gives us a chance to negotiate our relationship. What are the things that we agree on? What are the things that we disagree on? And how do we respect those things between us? And how do we build something based on those things? When you're in a relationship with healthy boundaries, you can disagree. And it's fine. There's nothing about that is like a full stop that's going to cause everything to crumble. When you're in a relationship that doesn't have healthy boundaries and you can't allow one another to disagree because you don't have healthy boundaries, then you have a problem. Then the relationship gets tense and it gets ugly. And so boundaries actually allow everyone to be their best self. And when you develop the skill of knowing what your boundaries are and setting your boundaries and communicating them to other people, you give yourself the gift of having really great relationships with people, really loving relationships with people. We're not taught how to do that. No. And I really want everybody to be taught how to do that. It makes life so much richer and full of love and tenderness and acceptance and peace. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, boundaries are about peace. If I know a boundary and one of my boundaries, and there's someone who doesn't respect it, I can walk away from whatever that situation is and I don't have any hard feelings. You didn't respect my boundary, I'm going. I don't have to get angry.
Right.
I don't have to carry some kind of tension with me. I don't have to like it. but I can have peace with that. I can say we're both doing what's best for us. I'm doing what's best for me, and I'm going to get out of this situation now. And so there's peace there.
The first thing that popped into my mind was people pleasing, because when I would say for a lot of my business, I didn't have healthy boundaries, and it's still something that I'm learning. I'm still learning to know what's best for me and what's best for my business. but there's still that desire to want to please people. And I'll let my boundaries go to make someone else happy. And that creates misery for me. And so I think the question that I would have for you, Kay, is, you know, knowing that there's that desire to please people, how do we learn to really respect our own boundaries and communicate them so that we don't get stuck in that cycle of misery and people pleasing?
Well, I just want to let you know, by the way, that you're totally normal. I think that's a big part of entrepreneurship is learning what's okay and what's not okay with you. And, you know, we can be in business for 10 years or even 20 years and suddenly realize we've been doing something all along that's not okay. Mm-hmm. Or that we don't. And so it's just part of being human. I think one of the most complicated things about boundaries is that really the way that you can realize you need a boundary is when someone violates it or makes an error that makes you realize, oh, wait a minute, that's not okay with me. And so it literally can be very difficult to set a boundary without knowing that you need it. Often something uncomfortable has to happen before you can know that you need one. I wish it were different, but it's not. That's just the way it is. And so it's that ability to go back and be able to look at a situation and say, you know, I didn't like the way that happened. And I can see several times over the years I've done this and I didn't like that either. And I'm not going to do that anymore. So then we get into the business of forgiving yourself for something you did in the past and reconciling that with trying to do something different in the future. And that's a whole different conversation. But that also is part of boundaries. Like we end up blaming ourselves for not having set a boundary earlier. But that's just the way it works. Can't set a boundary until you know you need one. So that's all a part of growth. And I think that's a healthy part of business. It's certainly a huge part of being an entrepreneur. It took me a long time to realize in my business that I need to block off certain chunks of time so that I can do creative work like my podcast. I don't do any work on Sundays. I don't check my email. I don't check any social media. That is for sure my day off. And then there's some other chunks of time that I have to block that I don't check my email and I don't do other things. That's a boundary that I need to protect my time. Time is a big boundary we can all talk about. So I have actually done the same thing. And I expect that I will go through the rest of my entrepreneurial career and the rest of my life waking up one day and saying, oh, there's a boundary I need to set. I did something happen that I don't like. And so I'm going to change the way I do this now. So it's just part of the process.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like too, if someone listening to this struggles with setting and respecting their boundaries, perhaps an experiment would be in order for them.
Oh, for sure. An experiment would be in order for them. And especially when it comes to boundaries, part of the experiment is usually one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, three steps back.
So true.
That's the way it happens with boundaries. Nothing has gone wrong. That is not a problem. You know what you have after that happens? You have data. So I set this boundary and it worked great. And then this one circumstance came up and I let someone violate that boundary. Now I know that when that circumstance comes up next, I will be different and I will not let my boundary be violated again. That is the way it works.
So you mentioned you're working on several things. What do future experiments look like for you?
Ugh, these are exciting. I love experiments. I love them and they terrify me at the same time. So I'm coming at this from both perspectives there, that I'm totally in love with what I've got coming up and I'm scared to death about it. So the next thing that I have coming up, starting in the middle of October, I'm going to be doing a month-long virtual workshop on boundaries and the holidays.
Perfect.
I do a lot of work with my clients on boundaries, but I haven't necessarily. And I've done a lot of work with clients over the years in group settings on boundaries when I've done a lot of work in corporate America. I haven't yet done an entire workshop based solely on boundaries. So I'm super excited about it and I'm a little terrified. So that'll be coming up in the middle of October. And I don't even have I don't even have enough details yet for people to register. You know, they would have to listen to the podcast to find out those registration details. And then coming up at the beginning of next year, so the beginning of 22, starting in just about the second week of January, I'm going to do a workshop on boundaries in the new year. So instead of setting a resolution in the new year, look at boundaries. Or maybe it will be, maybe the resolution to set is around real self-care. And real self-care comes from boundaries. So that'll be coming up. And then the plan is at the beginning of March of 22 is that I am going to launch a membership, a monthly membership for caregivers to have a place to come and be coached and to nurture one another in this new way of thinking where there's no shame and there's no blame and there's no sort of harmful advice giving. And instead, it's people learning to communicate about being a caregiver in a way that we can dare to live our own lives and support one another in really healthy ways, not necessarily, you know, falsely positive. I don't believe in toxic positivity, but we can support one another in ways that are healthy and so that we can live our best lives, which just happen to include being people with caregiver responsibility. So that's coming up next March. And I'm super scared about all of that. And I'm really, really excited too.
Thank you for modeling what it looks like to be not only scared of what you're doing, but excited. I think that combination is admirable. And I look forward to hopefully modeling that to others as well as I take on things that I'm scared of yet excited about.
It's a pretty, it feels good, doesn't it, Chris? Doesn't it feel good to know that you can be both scared and excited about the same, mm-hmm. about something at the same time? And that's totally okay. It's mm-hmm. not a problem. Yeah. I can do this. I can let myself be scared and excited and just know that that's going to be my experience. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, Kay, last question for you.
All right.
What book, podcast, or resource is blowing your mind right now?
I was glad that you sent this particular question to me in advance. If people don't know that that happens in the world of podcasting, that happens because I really needed to be prepared for this. There was a book that I read. I finished it about 2 weeks ago, maybe, mm-hmm. and it's called American Dirt. The author is Janine Cummins. I went onto Libby, you know, I borrowed it electronically and I went onto Libby and it was just, here's what's available now. And I thought, oh, this looks interesting. And I have to say that it kind of devastated me. It's about the experience of Mexicans immigrating into the United States illegally. So in other words, you know, using a coyote and hiding from authorities and what that looks like. And it was incredibly beautiful. And one of the things that I always challenge myself to do is seek outside of my own experiences and outside of my own comfort zone. And this certainly wasn't anything I knew anything about. I mean, you know, we all hear about it all the time on the news, or we think we hear about it. And I was really uncomfortable while I read most of the book. And I read a big portion of it. I was supposed to be away. I was away visiting friends for the weekend and I was so unsettled and so uncomfortable and I learned so much. It's probably on my list of top 5 books now that wow. I've ever read because it pushed me so far and the beauty was so extreme. And I also don't know if I'll ever be able to go back and read it again because it really, I ended up being in a very, very raw place at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And it was totally amazing. So that's American Dirt is the name of the book.
Well, Kay, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Thank you for all the things that you do for caregivers, but also thank you for what you do for me in terms of helping me work through my own emotions and sometimes lack of data from my experiments. So thank you for the constant push outside of my comfort zone and helping me build a business that I can grow into and, you know, be able to do when I'm 50 and 60.
We've got a working partnership that I really value and cherish. So thank you for letting me like live into my full voice. I wouldn't be able to do that alone. And I don't know that I would be able to do that with anybody else at this point. And it's made my life better. I mean, it's made my work better, but it's made me better as a person to have this thing that started as an experiment be now this weekly piece of art. It's become art that I get to sink into and bring value to the world and meaning to the world. And that's because of our partnership. So thank you too, Chris.
As I mentioned, Kate is my business coach, and she has been working with me for several months now. And the work that she has done has thoroughly transformed my business. And one of the ways that she's done that is to bring the power of noticing my emotions, my thoughts, my beliefs, the stories that I'm telling about myself, and combining it with my spirit of experimentation. One of the byproducts of our work together has been to launch Curiosity Builders, an online community for creators, dreamers, storytellers, and do-gooders just like you. It's a safe place for people to connect, learn, grow, and share. And you can sign up for free at curiosity.builders or at the link in this episode's show notes at gwtw.co/547. When you join the community, you can even say hi to Kay and ask her any questions about what she had to say in today's conversation. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.